Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to Centerpoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. In this show, we will discuss ways that we can journey to our own centers. This can help us access our inner resources to improve our physical abilities and health, our mental strength, our emotional well-being, and our spirituality. And today, I'm honored to introduce our special guest, Dr. Lawrence Diller. Hi, Larry.
Hey, Ron.
So, Dr. Diller is like an amazing, nationally known figure in behavioral pediatrics. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He is a behavioral developmental pediatrician and family therapist. He has evaluated and treated 5,000 children and their families over the past 44 years. He works in Walnut Creek, which is a San Francisco Bay Area suburb, and lives nearby in the Montclair neighborhood of Oakland with his wife, Denise. Dr. Diller is an assistant clinical professor at the University of California, San Francisco. He has written countless articles on children's behavior and psychiatric medication for the professional and lay literature that have garnered national and international notice. His book, Running on Ritalin, A Physician's Reflect on Children, Society, and Performance in a Pill, was published in 1988, and it was featured in a Time magazine cover story on Ritalin. He provided expert testimony on Ritalin before a U.S. Congressional Committee in May 2000, and the President's Council on Bioethics in December 2002. There's a lot more, but I edited down your biography. Larry, can you tell us, a lot of my listeners are my patients who are older teenagers and young adults, and I always like to ask our guests if they can tell us how they got into their career. Can you tell us about your early background?
Well, you know, my dad was a GP, you know, a general practitioner. And I saw how much he enjoyed his work, you know, and I, without a doubt that influenced me in terms of thinking about medicine as a career. And then I was at Columbia University in medical school, and I really liked the pediatricians because I think they were the only docs who really took the patient and the family in as a whole, where most of my other teachers who were really brilliant and such tended to look at organ systems like hearts and kidneys, etc. And then at UCSF, just totally by accident, I was exposed as an intern to a week of following a school-age child through a multidisciplinary evaluation, which nowadays is routine, but for me in 1976 was a total eye-opener on how to approach children's learning or behavior problems. And so I figured I would do the fellowship because after the shots and runny noses, Mom brings Johnny in because he's acting up or he can't read. Little did I know I would wind up becoming a specialist in that area.
You know, I'm always struck by how people's careers are shaped by incidents, by coincidences. And I always wonder, is it meant to be, or just this is how we go through life when we encounter something and it leads us? What do you think?
You know, I think it's a combination. I think, you know, the other career I've had is this advocacy part of my life where, you know, I wrote my first Ritalin prescription in 1980. So I've never been against medicine, but beginning in the mid-90s, I started to become uncomfortable with what I felt was an imbalance between addressing children's problems with a drug-only approach versus, you know, a more multidisciplined approach, or at least considering non-drug interventions first. And I finally felt I had to really speak up about it. And I think it's actually interesting. I thought about this, that I think it's my parents surviving the Holocaust, you know, in Europe as Jews, that has led me to have a ultra sensitivity about, you know, you got to speak up. You can't be quiet. You got to speak up. And I think, so I think it's both serendipity, but I think it's what we bring to the table as well.
Fascinating. In the 1990s is when I started asking the same question, do we just treat with, I was a pulmonologist, do we just treat with medicine, or is there, should we treat more holistically? So let's back up a second. You prescribed Ritalin in 1980, presumably for somebody with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Can you explain for our audience what that is?
I'm cackling because I remember a pediatric friend of mine who said, you know, I thought I knew what ADHD was in the 1980s, but by the mid-1990s, I don't know what it is anymore, all right? So I can tell you, you know, both officially what it is. I can tell you how I think the culture generally experiences it. Okay, and then I can tell you a more nuanced view of what I think goes on with someone who we call ADHD. That could be a kind of long answer. What do you want me to do?
I want the long version because you're the expert.
Okay. So technically, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is a psychiatric disorder as defined by the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Psychiatry number 5. If you meet 6 of 9 criteria, either for impulsivity or hyperactivity or for inattention, you officially meet the criteria for the diagnosis. I can be particularly exacting about it because people frequently speak in terms of I have ADHD or my child has ADHD, and technically there it's inaccurate because there's no biological or even psychometric test that defines ADHD. Rather, you meet a set of behavioral criteria. Okay. This is not true just of ADHD, by the way, but of all psychiatric disorders. What ADHD has come to mean in the society is that a biological personality-based problem with getting things done. That's what I think it's come down to, that people, children or people, who are not meeting either their own or society's expectations. And it isn't simply an issue of the child saying, I don't want to do it, okay, but rather maybe it's something that he can't do because of distractibility or hyperactivity or impulsivity. The nuanced view is it's never a strict situation of can't or won't. All right, this is what the parents are believing or the adult is believing. But it's a combination of the demands on the child, okay, and the responses to that child. And very often it's some notion of somewhere between won't and can't. I would say I'm comfortable with using the term it's harder for the child or harder for the person to get the things done that are expected of him or her. Harder implies that there are personality factors involved here, but harder also implies that given the right environment, the right situation, the right motivations, all right, that the kid can perform without the use of medicine, all right? But I'm not against medicine, and I think given when people have tried pretty hard otherwise, medicine certainly has its place.
Got it. So, you know, I've always thought that somebody who has difficulty in accessing information or learning information because they of inattention, after a while they feel like they can't do it and they don't even want to try anymore because it's too hard. Is that kind of thing? What you're talking about, how they combine the...
Precisely. It's almost a vicious feedback loop. It may be harder for them at some point. They start to feel overwhelmed, and then they give up. But I also want to throw in here, I have this whole separate category called teenage ADHD, which I think is very much a phasic quality of a transition in life, beginning maybe as early as age 13 or 14, and often lasting to 18 or 19, when the interest and motivation of the adolescent is directed to many things and not especially for academics. Okay, and that doesn't mean, again, that the kid won't benefit from taking medicine, but I don't see it as a lifelong disorder, as is often portrayed on the internet or the media.
Yes, so somebody, let's say, has ADHD, and I want to talk a lot more about how to treat it without medications, but you start off by saying in 1980 you gave Ritalin, which is a stimulant. Can you explain how that works in this setting?
Sure. Amphetamine, all right, was synthesized in the late 1920s, and by the 1930s it was pretty clear the good and bad parts about amphetamine, okay? Ritalin, Concerta, Adderall, Vyvanse, they're all variations of amphetamine. And in low doses, and I use that word low very specifically, low doses of amphetamine will get anybody, child or adult, ADHD or not, to stick with things they find boring or difficult. It also makes a person much more methodical and deliberate. So there's no paradoxical effect of a stimulant calming a hyperactive kid down. That's a medical urban legend that continues to persist decades into knowing better. The calmness that you see in the hyperactive, impulsive child is simply the child sticking with things longer and becoming much more methodical and deliberate in what they do. I tell the kid, you'll have a second or two longer to think things through before you do the dumb thing, okay? But if you really want to do the dumb thing, it won't stop you from doing it.
So why shouldn't we all take stimulants? Sounds pretty good.
Yep. Well, I think in our country, in fact, so many people are taking stimulants right now because they will improve performance, they will improve mood somewhat, okay, and make people much more efficient. The current shortage of stimulants is a result simply of an off-the-scale demand, particularly since the pandemic lockdown. The trouble with, well, first of all, most of us can do what we need to do without the use of a performance enhancer. But increasingly, as the demands on people to perform in order to keep up with the declining standard of living in the United States, performance enhancers are very attractive. The trouble with using Adderall or primarily Adderall or Ritalin is that there's a long history of ultimately of the society not being able to handle it in the form of misuse, abuse, and addiction. And I think, you know, the drug has been around since 1928. There's been several waves of doctor-prescribed stimulant abuse and addiction, and we're absolutely headed toward another one now.
Can you tell us more about what does stimulant abuse mean and what does addiction mean in this setting?
Stimulant abuse is when you're not using the medicine in a safe and proper way that may lead to extremes in behavior. You know, I don't prescribe immediate release Adderall to anyone over the age of 6 or 7, all right? It is the drug of choice for getting that 3 to 4 hours of a hit of extra performance. It's also the drug of choice for crushing and snorting, and it's also the drug that people most likely get into trouble with. The intermittent use of the drug, the use of the drug to stay up for all-nighters or to perform for 24 hours, the recreational use of the drug are all setups for abuse and ultimately addiction. The addiction to Adderall would be no different than the addiction to methamphetamine.
And what kind of, if you're addicted, what kind of withdrawal symptoms do you get from Adderall or methamphetamine?
The addiction and withdrawal to methamphetamine by reputation is worse than the addiction to an opiate or narcotic. The extreme ups and downs, particularly the downs, the depression and the sense of despair, the erratic behavior on the manic highs of the stimulants, and the craving for the stimulant when you haven't had it is well described both in the, you know, the public literature and in the professional literature.
And how easy is it to get addicted to these?
How easy it is? I don't know what you mean by easy. Maybe define
so
easy.
You prescribe a stimulant to a person with ADHD, and do a certain percentage end up addicted to it, or if they take it safely, it's okay?
I think under the right supervision, the drugs are pretty safe. There's been almost a 80-year track record of its use in children. There is one long-term side effect with proper use, and that's a mild to moderate decrease in the ultimate height of the child. A lot of parents don't know that, but I think by now that's well established. All right. The trouble here is it's safer in children than in adults, okay? Children don't have access to the medicine, and they actually don't like the higher doses. They complain about being nervous or it feels weird. Adults, and I'd say adults meaning mid-adolescents and older, often have access to the drug, and they like the higher doses. It makes them feel powerful. It makes them feel grand. All right. So I don't know how easy it is to get addicted. Used properly, it can be quite safe. I know that about 8 years ago, NIDA did a telephone survey of stimulant abuse and found pretty much the rates of abuse and addiction were one quarter that of the opiates. The opiates now have gone down in terms of abuse because of the scandals involving OxyContin, while rates of stimulant use have skyrocketed from 6 or 7 years ago. So I think the average person might be able to get by to it, but as a society, I predict there will be a moment of truth. And the society, as it's done in the previous 80 or 90 years of stimulant use, will say this is too dangerous a drug to be used as liberally as we're using.
And while we're talking about drug therapy for ADHD, can you teach us a bit about non-stimulant treatments?
Oh, okay, we can. I think I'm going to be interrupted here by the time. You want me to start with that question right now?
Sure. If the break comes up, we'll just pick it up after the break. So go ahead.
Okay. I think for children, and I would say, you know, children are being told, parents are being told their three-year-old is hyperactive and ADHD, so children as young as three, the main idea here is to, first of all, for the school-age child, to make sure that there are no hidden learning or processing problems, because that can present as ADHD, and if you can address that and put the kid in a more special ed environment, a lot of the problems of performance will disappear. All right. And the other thing, and this is a challenge for parents in this our current culture, that the current culture is teaching parents to deal with their kids in a more cognitive talk so that they will hear you kind of thing. In my experience with ADHD Johnny, if you try talking to him, he's halfway down the street before you finished your first sentence. So a more behavioral approach that emphasizes immediacy of tangible consequence. And that's not spanking a child, okay, but that's talking less, giving them fewer chances, and taking an action very, very quickly, either a reward or consequence is the way to go. I use a book for the younger kids. I wish I had written this book. My best book sold 40,000 copies. His book has sold 2.5 million copies. It's 1-2-3 Magic by Thomas Phelan. Okay? And parenting strategies and school step strategies that emphasize immediacy of consequence is the way to go with the impulsive or hyperactive child.
So we've started to talk about non-medication approaches to ADHD, and there's a lot more to unpack there, obviously. The other question, actually interesting, I thought I was asking the question, are there non-stimulant medications for ADHD? I might not have said that, or you didn't. So maybe we can also touch upon that when we come back from the break. This is CenterPoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
Coming attraction, Life Guide for Teens, Harnessing Your Inner Power to Be Healthy, Happy, and Confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Anbar to be published early 2025. Dr. Ambar's renowned counseling practice, CenterPoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Ambar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At CenterPoint Medicine, with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at CenterPointMedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Audiobooks gives you instant access to over 50,000 of the bestsellers and hottest book titles in romance, mystery, fiction, and many other genres. Just visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on Audiobooks to get started.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
More exhilarating talk. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to CenterPoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. Our very special guest, Dr. Lawrence Diller, who is an expert in the treatment of ADHD and other behavioral issues. So when we talk about non-medical approaches, I was told that a child with ADHD in a structured environment can do really well, and if the environment is not structured, they can go very badly. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, well, that's what I was talking about a moment ago, the notion of immediacy, of consequence. The hyperactive kid will require closer monitoring and more immediacy, all right? And the goal here is to try to do this within as normal an environment as possible, and that's where the medicines potentially are useful in keeping the child within as normal an environment as possible. I think the way to go is to first, again, make sure there aren't learning or processing problems, and make sure the parenting is reasonable. I mean, there are lots of reasons why kids don't get the work done. Many of them are coming from poor and chaotic environments. Many of them have some form of PTSD. Some of them are too anxious. Okay, so you know, ADHD is supposed to be a diagnosis of exclusion. You're supposed to go through all these other ones. The reality is, it's often just a two-person checklist that the pediatrician gives to the mother and the teacher. And if he crosses the threshold, the pediatrician's doing a good job. You know, kid's got ADHD. If you come to me, there's going to be a little bit more time in terms of trying to figure out what's going on. But essentially, the notion of this structure and immediacy of consequence is to be tried at home and at school. If the kid is still struggling, I would say, you know, you give it at least a couple weeks, 2 or 3 months. If the kid is still struggling in this normal environment, the parents at that point have a choice. Do they want to give a trial of a stimulant medication to see what it does? Or potentially, do they need a more specialized environment? Do they need someone coming into the classroom? Does the kid need more small group instruction? These are all other alternatives to the medicine, but a lot of families at that point would opt for the medicine.
What about things like cognitive behavioral therapy or hypnosis therapy? Does that play around?
You're the hypnosis expert. I don't believe that for the school-age child, and maybe even for the teenager, it's going to make a lot of difference. Whether or not the adult could benefit from hypnosis, a highly motivated adult, it isn't described a lot in the ADHD literature, but you would know more about it than I do. But I think the cognitive behavioral approaches are ill-suited to this kind of temperament, okay? And they're ill-suited to the inconsistently motivated adolescent is also not going to use cognitive behavioral approaches.
So I completely concur with you, and with hypnosis, the main thing I ask when people say, could this work, I said, depends on a young person's motivation. If they're very motivated, and I've had some adolescents who were very motivated for whom hypnosis has worked, but they're in the minority. That wouldn't be my first go-to, as you suggest.
Okay.
So if a child comes to you for evaluation and you think they have ADHD, I'm here going to make some structural changes in the way their life is structured. You're going to wait several weeks, two or three months, and then the parent might decide to put them with a child who says, I'd like to try the medication. So when we talk about medication, are there medications that are not stimulants that are helpful in treatment of ADHD?
Right. Well, you know, the holy grail of ADHD medication is to find something that works as well as amphetamine, but it doesn't have the reputation of amphetamine nor the potential risks that I've already mentioned. And you know what? They haven't come up with anything in 70 years, all right? The non-stimulant drugs currently, the one that was highly touted but has faded from the scene is atomoxetine or Strattera. It just doesn't work as well in head-to-head competition or looking at it compared to either amphetamine, which would be Adderall, or methylphenidate, which would be Concerta. And it has its own side effects. The other drugs that are really attractive right now for the hyperactive children are these alpha agonist drugs, Intuniv and 10X guanfacine. These were initially blood pressure medicines that were tested in very small groups of ADHD kids and felt to calm them down. They are sedating medicines. Unlike the stimulants, all right, which I told you will help focus and will help make a kid more deliberate but are not sedating, the guanfacine and Tuniv group are sedating. They are finding an increasing place, particularly in the evenings, for families where the kid, where you have to let the stimulant wear off by around dinner time, because there are effects on appetite and sleep with you know, the stimulants, like with coffee, very similar. So this other group, you're finding increasing use, particularly in the evenings. I'm generally able to manage children without the use of these sedating agents.
Gotcha. So, can you just explain? I've always been confused when I, as a clinician, diagnose ADHD, it gives me a choice of inattentive type or hyperactive type. What's the difference?
What's the difference is, you might think actually they're both called ADHD. They're completely different problems most of the time. You know, the hyperactive type, it's called ADHD combined type, which means you're both hyperactive, impulsive, and you're inattentive, all right? That is a problem of, again, impulsivity and overactivity. The inattentive type really, I think, is a problem of processing, and 80% of those children will have a learning or processing problem. Russell Barkley, the guru of ADHD in America, wanted to call it a different name. He wanted to call it sluggish cognitive tempo, all right? But it's not going to fly. The parents don't like it, and the powers that be aren't going to do it. The only similarity between ADHD combined type and ADHD inattentive type is its response to stimulant drugs. And since stimulant drugs will affect everybody the same way, it's a shame that these two very different problems have been combined, you know, in a confusing way under attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. In fact, calling attention as the main problem, I think, is a misleading too. I would, the kids very often with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder hyper-focus on things that they like or they're interested in. And how can you have attention deficit if you're hyper-focusing? I'll continue that after the break.
Well, this is fascinating. So, I want to hear more about hyper-focusing kids and what does that have to do with ADHD, and I also would like to ask you several questions about whether ADHD has been overdiagnosed, and then, of course, I assume you will tell us that stimulants have been overdiagnosed as well. We'll be right back. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.
Make-A-Wish has been granting life-changing wishes for children and families for over 40 years. A wish is something that gives children the opportunity to look outside their illness and restore a sense of childhood back to the child. With the help of donors and more than 43,000 worldwide volunteers, Make-A-Wish has collectively granted more than 520,000 wishes worldwide. Dr. Anbar has referred many patients to Make-A-Wish. To make a donation, go to worldwish.org. That's worldwish.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com or visit DrAnbar.com.
Reach your health and fitness goals. Whether you want to lose weight, learn to dance, build muscle, or just live healthy, Beachbody gives you unlimited access to the nation's most popular fitness and weight loss solutions. Visit our advertiser page and click on Beachbody now.
Dr. Ron Ambar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Coming attraction, life guide for teens harnessing your inner power to be healthy, happy, and confident. A new book by Dr. Ron Ambar to be published early 2025. Dr. Ambar's renowned counseling practice, Centerpoint Medicine, doesn't fix teens who are struggling. They give them the tools to heal themselves and support them while that healing happens. Life Guide for Teens will share Dr. Ambar's tools for self-empowerment and give teens hundreds of tips to choose from to help themselves heal. The book will be available from Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
All positive talk with a mature edge. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Centerpoint. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Ambar. Our special guest, Dr. Lawrence Diller, who's teaching us about ADHD. And we were just talking about hyper-focusing, so please continue.
I mean, you know, it's almost like Orwellian doublespeak, you know. I mean, how can someone who's hyper-focusing, how does hyper-focus become part of the syndrome of something called attention deficit? It's contradictory, because I think what the problem is, the kid or the person is spending too much time on something that they're interested in, they like, but not doing the thing that they're supposed to do. If I had to really define the more universal quality of what ADHD is all about, it's the relative inability to make yourself do something that you know you gotta do, okay, but isn't of interest or is too hard. That aspect, you know, the notion of knowing you have something you got to do, for most people will create an anxiety that they address by getting it done. But there's a subgroup of people who have that anxiety and they play a video game or they go online to social media. Are you following me, that Ron? Okay.
Yep.
And so they deal with that anxiety by getting distracted onto something else. I mean, but the little kid who gets distracted, again, similarly, it's this difficulty of making him or herself do what he's being told to do at that time.
But it's not an attention problem in many cases.
I think it's less of an attention problem. In fact, again, I quote Russell Barkley. His great tome back in the late 1990s, he talked about struggling between this problem a problem of attention or a problem of motivation, all right? And he ultimately chose attention because he saw the motivational aspect of it as raising a lot of difficult moral and ethical questions about what constitutes a disorder. Okay, and the issues of responsibility, if it was an issue of motivation rather than attention. But Dr. Barkley has been clear, ADHD is at best an explanation, but not an excuse for behavior.
Yes, I have too many kids who tell me, oh, I can't do this because I have ADHD, as the explanation for their lack of motivation.
Right, right. And you know, it's attractive to think about that and say that, but if it's properly managed by the parents and the doctor, the kid won't get away with that.
So, do you think ADHD is being overdiagnosed?
What can I say about that, Ron? I mean, the way I would put it, every culture has its strengths and weaknesses. In the United States, we generally use per capita stimulants, you know, 4 or 5 times what they're using in Western Europe. It's like 100 times more than what they use in India or China. So does that mean we're diagnosing ADHD more? Clearly we are, all right? Is it being overdiagnosed here and underdiagnosed there? You know, I can't comment. What I would comment on is I think we're absolutely on our way to, a doctor-prescribed stimulant abuse epidemic. I think we're there. It just doesn't make the headlines. So is that a sign that we're doing too much of it? Yeah, I would say yes. I would say yes.
And so when you testified in front of Congress, what was the content of that? What were you telling them?
Oh, this was back in the early 2000s when the culture was still getting used to medicating, 4 and 5 year olds, okay? And so, the culture has gotten over that and they're just medicating 5 year olds all the time. Okay, that was back there in the 2000s. The President's Council on Bioethics was a more interesting one in terms of talking about exactly a little while ago about, the morality or what our tech is talking about in the use of performance enhancers at work, in sports. That was what the bioethics talk was about back in the day.
So let's talk about that. What I asked earlier, what's wrong with using stimulants safely to augment yourself? What are the ethics of that?
Well, I think the sports one has been strongly delineated, and then we'll move back to the outside of sports. The reason why all sports bans the use of amphetamine and other performance enhancers is that the idea is somehow that the event and the achievement of the event is somehow cheapened if one uses a drug to get there as opposed to one's own efforts. That's number one. Number two is if they allow performance enhancing drugs in sports, it puts pressure on all the athletes to use the performance enhancers. It's called free will under pressure. And so all the professional leagues technically ban the use of amphetamine because it does improve sports performance minimally, okay, minimally. But on the highest levels, I like to say the Stanford swim team in the 1950s was given amphetamine, and it improved the overall performance of the team in all events by 4%. 4% doesn't sound like much, but in the 4-minute mile, that's 9 seconds. 9 seconds, okay? So, but in the year that they banned steroids in baseball, because the Cincinnati Reds went on strike insisting that amphetamine also be banned, the number of major leaguers who had ADHD signed by a doctor who could have amphetamine in their urine went from 36 to 124. Okay? So there are definitely ways of participating in sports with amphetamine. Now, the question is, what about in school? What about in business? What about in war? Do we have time to talk about that right now, or should I save it for the next
break? We have time. Let's get started. Very curious.
Well, in war, Rommel, Erwin Rommel of the North Africa Corps was the first general to give his troops amphetamine, and they were ubermenschen. When the Allies found out about it, they gave their troops amphetamine too. The Germans and the English decided a guy with a gun on amphetamine is too erratic, and they stopped it, all right? The Americans continued, and many GIs came back from World War II addicted to amphetamine by their superior officers. But what about in business or in school to get the upper hand? What if one guy I had, working for Schwab, when he first started, 3 decades ago, he only had to look at 20 stocks. By the time I saw him, he had to follow 100 stocks, and he couldn't do it on his own chemicals. the idea would be maybe you shouldn't be doing that job anymore, Joe. But nevertheless, people are attracted very much to the amphetamine to stay on the job. I think after the break I'll talk about school.
Great, and I'm curious again about the abuse potential, which is, from what I'm hearing, is that's the major reason that we shouldn't use it so widely, if I understand correctly.
This is the center point.
We'll come back. This is center point. This is with Dr. Ron Anbar.
More than 30,000 children and adults of every race and ethnic group in the U.S. have cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a disease causing long-lasting lung infections, limiting the ability to breathe over time. Dr. Anbar participated in research that helped advance survival of cystic fibrosis patients by more than 20 years. He encourages you to donate to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation to help find a cure. It's easy to donate. Go to cff.org. That's cff.org.
HealthyLife.net, the positive radio network.
If you are a medical or licensed healthcare professional or just anyone looking for a qualified hypnosis practitioner, then go on over to ASCH.net. That's the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. At ASCH.net, you can get certified, attend workshops, and even find a hypnosis practitioner or consultant. ASCH provides an opportunity to learn and interact with colleagues. So whether you're a professional wanting to learn hypnosis or a patient wanting help with a problem, visit ASCH.net now.
Constant Contact and your small business make a perfect fit for marketing. They give you what you need to succeed. Fast and easy email marketing at your fingertips. Visit the HealthyLife.net advertiser page and click on Constant Contact to start your marketing.
Healing and changing children's lives with hypnosis is very real and very possible. Dr. Ron Anbar's new book, Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis, provides you meaningful stories and expert explanations to show you not only the process of hypnosis, but its many benefits for overall wellness. Whether a parent, practitioner, or medical doctor, this book opens the way to complete connection, so necessary for healing. Get your copy of Changing Children's Lives with Hypnosis at Amazon.com. Or visit dranbar.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Dr. Ron Anbar and his dedicated team of healthcare providers offer unique health services to help patients overcome psychological roadblocks or use the power of their minds to improve their overall health and well-being. At Centerpoint Medicine with services in La Jolla, California and Syracuse, New York, this caring staff are waiting just to help you. Find out more at centerpointmedicine.com. Can't wait? Make your appointment now. Call 858-201-4001. That's 858-201-4001.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Welcome back to Center Point. I'm your host, Dr. Ron Anbar. Our very special guest, Dr. Lawrence Diller, who's educating us greatly. So tell us about school. Tell us about abuse.
Okay, so the ethics of using a performance-enhancing drug is what we've been talking about, okay? And again, I think the ethical burden is higher in giving it to a child because a child doesn't decide for his or herself. And the consequences of using the medicine as a child could have lifelong effects. From the health point of view, I think I told you again, I feel that the use of the medicine when the child has no choice but to attend school seems justified to help them to get through that period of time when other non-drug interventions have been attempted. This is even in the face of the long-term data showing that the use of stimulants in children does not affect long-term outcome. And you can say, well, if it's not going to affect long-term outcome, why do it? Well, I think it allows the kid to get through a tough time when the kid doesn't have any choice on what to do. The adult over 18 doesn't have to go to school. They can get another job. technically they aren't as stuck, okay? But the reality is many people don't want to change the job or can't change the job or whatever, and the attraction of a performance enhancer is very, very high. Many people can take the amphetamine drugs safely, but a large minority will get into trouble. That's been the experience of the previous 80 years, and that's where we're headed right now, absolutely headed right now.
So, sage, you know, sage words. In this last segment, I often ask our guests if they can give us, the audience, three tips based on their knowledge. It doesn't have to be regarding ADHD, but you're a wise man. You've been around decades, and wisdom is accumulated with experience. So I'm wondering if you can give three tips for better life or three tips to how people can help themselves take home with them.
In general or with regards to ADHD?
In general. Anything
in general,
you would like to tell us?
In general. What comes to mind is change is very hard. Change is not easy at all. I'm in the business of helping families change, particularly with children. Actually, I think influencing the parents to make changes with their kids can have a rather dramatic effect, and I've been very, very rewarded over the years to see how quickly the children can change when the parents or the school make the right step. You get up to adolescence, even in adolescence there can be changes, and the changes often occur simply because the kid is maturing and having to face the world. Now, changing as an adult becomes more difficult, all right? It can be done. It can be done without drugs, but more than anything, it requires courage. The courage to try something different. It isn't easy, all right? So talking to family, talking to friends, talking to a therapist, all right, may give that person the idea and motivation to make the change if they're unhappy. I don't know. I would say, taking a medication to help yourself shouldn't be considered an absolute failure. You know, you're in a situation that may be difficult. Medications can make a really big difference in a selected group of people, all right? And so, you know, saying I'm not going to take a medication, I'm going to solve this on my own is a worthy step and should be honored. But at a certain point, if you've tried a lot of stuff and you're still struggling, you shouldn't feel like a failure because you're trying either a stimulant or a Prozac or something like that. Those would be my general words of wisdom.
It's interesting you talk about people not wanting to use medication because they think they can do it on their own. I get people when I teach them hypnosis, I don't want to do the hypnosis. I don't want my subconscious up. I want to do it on my own. And I say, wait a minute, your subconscious is your own. That's a very interesting reaction.
I think part of your art and my art is framing the choices in a way that people can make change. You know what I mean? And I think that would have to be done pretty much on an individual basis.
Right. And adolescence, the advantage we have as therapists is change is happening whether they're ready or not.
I have this 45 years of experience. I can tell the parent of a 15-year-old how hard it is right now, and based on the parent's upbringing and their lives, I can virtually guarantee how good the kid will be doing at age 25. How bumpy it is to age 25, that I can't tell, and we're here to help with some of the bumps. And then the other thing is keeping the kid off of substances. You know, that can be very important, because if you get into substances, you can delay that maturing your whole life.
Now let me ask another question based on your long career. How have teenagers changed since the days of social media and the internet?
How has what changed?
Teenagers.
How have teenagers changed? I think it's a much broader issue than just social media. You're going to laugh, but I've been in practice since the 70s. I think feelings have become too important. I think we are so worried that children will feel badly even for a second that we try to create a world that you know is always accommodating and conflict is always avoided. But life is filled with stresses or challenges, and if you try to avoid the stresses and conflicts, the kid is very poorly prepared. All right, I think this current generation. Well, I should make a distinction. I just am seeing kids who are 12 and 13, and thank God. The society has become aware of the dangers of social media and screens and pornography and such. So this group of kids who are now 12 and 13, the families are much, much more protective and careful. But the age group, let's say 14 to 26 or 30, they have been significantly damaged by internet access, okay, and simply companies taking advantage of the insecurity of children and teens.
You know, I heard a term that was new to me recently, the bulldozer parent. I knew about the helicopter parents, micromanaged.
The bulldozer parents. A very good book to recommend, not my own again, along this line, is Jonathan Haidt's Haidt, The Anxious Generation. Have you read it, Ron?
I have not. I'll have to pick it up.
You really have to check it out, okay? I learned a new term called safetyism. You know, safetyism when the parents are too afraid to let the kid to go to the schoolyard by himself, even though they live only a block away.
Yeah. The bulldozer parent clears all the hurdles in front of the child, so the child never confronts the hurdles.
Right. Then, but that, again, that's a result, in my opinion, of parental anxiety generated by a culture where we have to get over our overemphasis on feelings. Just do it. Just do it. Okay.
I love it. Larry, I think I could talk to you all day, and maybe we'll talk again on the radio program. You're fascinating. You have such great insight, and I really appreciate you sharing some of your knowledge with us today.
All right. You know, I feel like Cassandra of the Trojan Wars. He had the gift of prophecy, but no one listened to him. You know what I mean? I've been saying this for a long time, and, you know, I think it's going to get bad with the stimulants at some point. I may be dead. Okay?
Well, on that note, I wish everyone a great week, and go ahead, motivate yourself to change. It's worth it. This is Centerpoint with Dr. Ron Anbar.